I think to start off, to start off, I would ask each of you up here to identify him or herself as what you were then and what you are now. You want to start, Nancy?
Thanks. I was a part-time operator slash consultant, and probably more appropriately also slash house mother. I'm still there. You can eliminate the first parameter, the job description.
My name's Steve Bobbs. What I currently am is a grad student at Carnegie Mellon University. Back then, we all went by the names of the programs. Back then, people would say, go up to me and say, hey, DET, how come such and such doesn't work? For example, I'm sitting next to one of the several people called BASIC. I've also worked on the Lisp system back then and a variety of other various things.
I'm Neil Wiedenhofer. I was a graduate student at Dartmouth back in those days. I worked mostly on the BASIC compiler. Now I'm a systems programmer for United Computing Systems. What time do I have?
So my name is John Medici, and my current job is to worry about things like getting people paid and making sure the accounting system runs. In those days, I was a student and worked about the time sharing system. The difference to what Steve Hobb said, as I recall it, I was there about a year before he was. We used to know our programs by the names of people who wrote them.
My name is Dave McGill. I'm currently a teacher of Transcendental Meditation and a systems analyst for Planning Research Corporation. And back in 64 to 68, I worked variously on the BASIC project and 635 and on some of the time-sharing project on 635.
My name is Ron Martin. Currently with the Cybernetics Corporation as Manager of Telecommunications Development. Been there for 5 years. Back in 63 through 67, I was a student at Dartmouth, and I worked together with Mike Bush in developing the first Internet 30 executive. After that, I worked on the MOLD system, which was a developmental time-sharing system of historical interest only, and also on the first 635 time-sharing system in both of the latter cases on the communications executive.
I'm Kevin O'Gorman. These days I run programming in BASIC and of BASIC for a small computer outfit in New York. And in those days, I guess I was Al Gall.
I'm Mike Bush. I'm presently in management at Computer Sciences Corporation. I've been involved extensively with CSC's InfoNet timesharing network, and more recently involved in facilities management for state and local government. Back then, I was involved in writing the first master executive for the DataNet 30 and perhaps John McGehee's principal adversary.
My name is John McKemeny. In those days, I worked with Tom Kurtz, who was in charge of the time-sharing system overall. I wrote the first BASIC compiler. I won't mention my present job, but it's clearly not nearly as good as the one I had in those days.
Tom Kurtz, and looking around the panel here, I think that Nancy and I are the only ones who are still doing the same things we did in 10 years ago.
My name is Sidney Marshall. I'm currently a scientist at the Xerox Corporation. And I started out on the LGB 30
I think I was the first high school student to start stealing time from college. And I worked on, I was not in at the original conception of the 235 system. I wrote TSAP, the old system, and a good part of the exec for the current system, which I suspect has now been chipped away by succeeding programmers.
Hi, my name is Greg Dobbs. I'm currently a research associate at MIT. Some of the other people that couldn't be here today, like myself, are not mathematicians. I'm in chemistry. That wasn't too uncommon at Kiewit for people from all types, pre-meds and whatever, to do systems programming. I inherited the editing systems for the 200 and in conjunction with Pete Nielsen, shepherded them through the mold system onto the 600.
My name is Jerry Wiener. I'm a new product manager at Pitney Bowes, and I'm the first one in industry that ever believed what Timoney and Kurt said could be done. I was the GE project manager, and my function was flying in spare parts when they burned them out. Although the DataNet 30 was standard off the shelf, it was standard off the shelf number 00 and one of 10 unique machines. We rebuilt it without telling it to people, things of that kind.
My name is George Detlitz, and I work for the General Electric R&D Center in Schenectady. And my participation on the 265 was to build the background Fortran system, which enabled the people with the bigger jobs to work in the background.
Would you please walk
to
the
light?
I can't
get the
sound.
My name is
George. We are going to switch.
My only comment is that this sounds just like the good old days. I'd like to start things off by asking a question. Does anybody here really remember what happened on May 1st, 1964?
I think you people with pioneers are missing the one crucial element of the pioneering, that's the user. I tried myself upon being in Thomas Kurtz's class in 1964, in the spring of 1964, and we started out in that class using BASIC on cars on a GE225 in the basement of College Hall. And then we moved from there to three terminals in the basement of College Hall, and Mr. Bush and Mr. McGeechee at the time just, I guess we used to call you McGeechee. We had a very difficult time with him because every time we were working in our program, he would follow the system.
Tom,
Shill's in the audience.
Tom, let me at least try to answer that, and I can't swear that this is true, but I think the goal we set ourselves was to have a program in BASIC work simultaneously in two terminals, and I think that's what happened early in the morning of May 1st, and it probably was adding 2 plus 2, and
if my recollection was right, I don't remember the specific incident, but it just had to be prime numbers by the sieve method.
Any rate, there was a relatively simple program in BASIC where both the program, the BASIC worked and time sharing worked, in that we got the right answer, the program to run on two terminals at the same time. Actually, you may think that's a very small achievement, but once we got to that point, things went terribly fast after that. I mean, from that to going to a larger number of terminals and having most of BASIC work really took much less time than that, the major breakthrough.
Let me comment on how fast things went. We went from phase zero to phase four in 9 months.
Just like the federal government. I think, since Tom is chairing this panel, I would like to make one remark about what really happened. A key event occurred really in the academic year 62-63. Serious planning started in the spring of 63, and a year and a half later there was a multi-terminal system in operation, and those you see here had a very major role to play with it. But how it really started, I think, goes back earlier than that, namely the fact that Tom Kurtz had a ridiculous dream. He had the idea that it would be possible to come up with a computing system where every student at Dartmouth would have a chance out to learn computing. Furthermore, he had the dream to make a computing system available the way an OpenStack library is available. One of the earlier panelists talked about that, but that was a terribly radical idea as recently as 11 years ago. For most academic institutions, it's still an unheard of idea. And I think as we talk about some of the details, one should not forget the fact that Tom really had those two absolutely key ideas that revolutionized educational uses of computers. The only other thing I remember about those days was that it was very good that both he and I were quite ignorant about computing, because we did not know that what we were about to attempt to do was impossible.
John, didn't you invent a particular way of solving problems when there were solving disputes when there were disputes or disagreements among the student programmers? Well, didn't you say once that they could solve the large problems, but you reserved the right to solve the small problems? I remember something like that. Am I the only one that remembers that?
Dartmouth was very selective in hiring computer operators at the time. I remember handing Professor Kimney decks of cards to put through the card reader, and then everybody ran over to the printer to see if BASIC was doing what BASIC was supposed to be doing at the time. This was before the time-sharing system was running, but he was debugging, and we were, I guess, helping him.
Does anybody remember the one-card wonders?
It's an in-card compile.
Yes, it was quite crucial, of course, because before you got time-sharing going, you had to get into the system basically with cards, and we had a number of single-card things, and it was a competition on how much you could make one single card do. Mike, do you remember some of them? I remember there were great competition on things everybody said you couldn't possibly get all on one card.
I think the winner of that contest was a program that produced one-card wonders.
Actually, that was the one-card wonder maker. Straighten that up.
Well, since we're reminiscing, let me mention one thing about the early days of BASIC. We only had one big argument on BASIC. The idea sounded very attractive, but coming up with a brand new computer language when Fortran was clearly going to be the only language ever used in computers, many people argued was a crazy thing to do, and that we might be leading our students down the wrong path in inventing a new language where, when they graduated from Dartmouth, it would not be usable in any other system except our own. I think 10 years later, it's safe to say we won that particular gamble. I'm trying to estimate Tom. I'm trying to estimate how close we are to the billion jobs being run in BASIC, but just from the statistics we saw, about 50 million of them must have been run by now at Dartmouth College, and given all the other places they use, we probably can claim that more than a billion jobs have been run in BASIC all over the world.
Well, I claim at least 10,000 myself.
GE did a survey of all of its major programming managers, and the conclusion was that BASIC had absolutely nothing to offer that wasn't done better in Fortran. And I said, you missed the point completely. It's a simple system for the user. Huh?
Well, getting down to some more, some amusing things, I seem to remember some funny things like wastebasket fires in the basement of a most unfireproof building being one of the hazards. Does anybody remember wastebasket fires? I guess those people are not here.
I went out at the end.
Yeah, I think I remember. I remember also one of our students that one time, only once, I saw actually put a cigarette into an ashtray. Unfortunately, the next thing he did was set a notebook on top of it.
It's interesting to see how much student assistance techniques have changed over the years. I remember when I first wrote my first system, it was time to debug it. I sit by the console typewriter and look at the lights. And when something that looked like my program swapped in the memory, I get carriage returned and finished off a dump command and dumped all of memory on the printer. see if I could figure out what was going on. That wasn't good enough. I went to the D30 and flipped the switch to prevent that jump the boot instruction from being loaded in the memory. So I came into memory, I hit manual and single step of my program to see what it was doing. Much to the very upsetting to the people upstairs in the terminal room, while I was single stepping their program, time sharing had definitely stopped. Nowadays I use fancy debuggers with symbol tables supplied by assemblers and multiple debugging. You can single step your program while everyone else runs. It's a real change.
Along this line, debugging the format statement processor for this Fortran system, I wrote a routine which did a trace by entering interrupt mode, printing out the contents of all the registers, setting an interrupt and exiting interrupt mode, and this spewed out paper for several hours before I found the error, but that was one of the nice things you could do about it.
As I remember, the first error you found was that you forgot to turn off the interrupts on the line printer.
Maybe.
I really think that the memory that sticks in my mind is not things like fires in waste paper baskets, but seeing Bush and McGeechee at the two machines. You see, one of the very big problems was, I think it was the first attempt of trying to have two different computers working in parallel and cooperating with each other. And the two of them took this terribly personally. I mean, it wasn't John's machine and Mike's machine. It was John and Mike who were not responding. And they would stand at opposite ends of the room and yell at each other at the top of their voices. And how they became lifelong friends in spite of that is something I will never understand. I wish you would tell us a little bit about the experience of debugging that two-part executive.
I have a story about that. one of our long-lasting quarrels, I got so sick and tired, I said, well, I'm going to fix it. And so I put a couple of messages in 235 executive. One message said, Bush did it. The other message said, I did it. I figured the message that says I did it would never come out. So I went away, and next day, this particular thing happened. And I was very embarrassed to see the message, I did it, appear in the console.
In the early days of development, before the 235 exec was working, the Data 30 exec was checked out with a little dummy routine that just sat in the 235 and responded with the right responses without doing any of the computing or processing. And this was the basis for many of the arguments that ensued, because we were absolutely sure that the Data 30 couldn't possibly be wrong because it always responded right with the simulator. Of course, completely ignoring the fact the simulator might be wrong. And I believe that was the fuel that convinced Mike that he was right, and of course John had his own reasons for thinking that he was.
I think our approaches to system reliability were sort of interesting too. I recall one time in the early days when we were developing the system, it didn't matter very much when you made changes, because the new versions were not really that much better than the old, and they all had bugs. Well, after the system had been running for about 6 months, people started to count on this. It became a little harder to put in new versions of the executive. So Mike and I developed this technique, appearing about 2 in the morning, putting in our new binary decks, taking the old decks and throwing them away. Just making sure the next day there was no way to back up. Unfortunately, we did this once when Professor Kennedy had a demonstration schedule.
Nobody's going to tell what happened.
I don't know. All I remember is getting up very early in the morning and driving into Hanover frantically from where we were staying that summer and trying to fix things. But I have no recollection of whether it ever worked again or not.
I have a little story I'd like to tell. There was always an immense feeling of power when you worked in the basement of College Hall. You knew those people were upstairs pounding away at the terminals, and you held their very life in your hands, essentially. Along the way, I had developed a little program, which is well remembered, I'm sure, by anybody who was there. It was a program which generated random sentences, and the subject matter of the sentences was completely obscene. And the interesting thing was that it wasn't enough that we were amused by the program,
But at one point, we even went and printed out reams of line printer paper to test out the first timesharing compatible batch BASIC. And we used to drive down to the Polka Dot or the Four Aces, and we'd sit there going through these reams of paper and looking for something that was more than just random, that just, you know, was considerably creative. And I remember the look on some of the waitresses' faces while we were doing that. We got kind of tired of that and found a new technique. We would sit at one of the control terminals of the system, change a few internal system pointers, and pawn our program off on an unsuspecting user. The only thing was, we didn't want to waste the time to look at who it was. So we never knew who the victims were. And what would happen from the user's point of view is that they would be typing in their program to solve a differential equation or whatever. And finally, they would be done. They would say, run. Somewhere along the line, I had slipped them this other program in place of the one they were creating. And instead of the output they expected, they would get these streams of random sentences. This story has kind of an interesting kicker to it. Several years later, when we had the dedication ceremony for Kiewit, the new computation center, I remember that Dr. Kreider was sitting up on the stage reminiscing at that point about some of his early experiences as a user. And I was in the audience with a couple of other people that remember the incident. And I remember he made some remark about how he sat down at his terminal and type run and how all this stuff came out on his terminal. And he never knew who did it. And I don't know that until just now that he ever did know who did it. The cat's out of the bag.
I think that, you know, people are cutting the reliability of systems short. I got there in 65, so I'm not sure if I'm a real pioneer. When I got there 1 year later, in September of 65, it was completely reliable. I mean, as far as I could see, they brought up experimental timesharing on Sunday, and no one could tell the difference that it was experimental. It seemed to work just as good as the regular days. We were one experimental session. Just to let people know it was really experimental, we went into the character translation table to take the internal BCD and translate it to the teletype and switch the entries for the digits 2 and 3. It made the BASIC program for I equals 10 to 100 go 10, 11, 13, 12, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 30. 31, 33, 32. This is no problem to a systems program, but at least let the users know it was experimental timeshare. Because it really was. When I got there, extremely reliable. I was amazed. I had some experience with CTSS at MIT. In reliability, it was much better. I was surprised that just a small system with relatively poor hardware that was that reliable.
I remember one thing about that. If you didn't have the program already typed in, you had the problem of being creative and typing your lines to either avoid line numbers containing the digits 2 or 3 or to use them properly. And properly is not an easy concept in this case. Because clearly, if the end statement wound up being sorted before the end of the program, it wasn't going to run. And other such similar problems, you could have four statements after your end, next statements and so forth.
I should mention the first person to patch that program changed the translation table from 2 to 3 and then discovered he had no 2s to put into the system to put the other patch in.
No, that was a serious problem, but we did it by using a third digit and an intermediate step.
And then there was the case where a slight modification of the program was made so that on March 15th, all output came out in Roman numerals.
Tom, I think I have a sequel to your story. One of our very ablest student programmers who graduated a couple of years ago finished a new version of BASIC, and he finished it sort of about the time he graduated, and lo and behold, 9 months after this gentleman left, on March 15th, everything started appearing in Roman numerals.
Maybe it was the same programmer.
I don't think so, because he wasn't there. Okay.
But the reliability of the system, I remember we used to, I think Nancy left. When did you leave, Nancy? But
well, I was off time sharing, so I've been there about 4 months. But at that point, we started, I was the only operator, and I was there during the day. And then all our student programmers were assigned hours during the evening when the system was up, where they were the official operator. And I think from looking at this crew, you can imagine, you know, 10 years ago, really how often they showed up when they were supposed to be there. Luckily, the system was sufficiently reliable, and there were pretty quickly enough knowledgeable people on campus that if you happened to be using the system and it stopped, well, there was one very common symptom, and everybody knew what it was, so you went down to the basement of College Hall, unlocked the door with a nail file or your ID card, whatever you happen to have handy, walked over to the ZIF, pushed one button, everything started up, and you went home. And the system sort of ran that way, eventually completely unattended over the weekends, and pretty much generally unattended.
Yeah, I remember one time, I got a call at night. It was actually quite late at night. And for some reason, the system, which normally would run and run and run and run, it went down on one of those rare occasions and needed somebody to come in and push that little red button on the disk. But the person who called didn't live in Hanover. As a matter of fact, he lived in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And he called me because I was the only one he knew phone number of, and said, the system went down. And I said, Jerry, you know what time it is. It's 3 a.m. in the morning. I'll be damned if I'm going to get up and go down and push that button.
Speaking of phone calls and things, one of probably the earliest program in the program library was football. And a lot of us here know who wrote it. And I remember one night, we'd been apparently having some problem somewhere along the line, and I got a phone call at home one night to tell me, in absolute panic, that football has been clobbered in the library. And I don't know, I live a good half hour away from Dartmouth, and I really wasn't about to jump in the car and trot in to reload it from cards, or paper tape was probably what we had for backup at that point. So I just sort of sleepily said, well, I'll put it back in the morning. But what did you really expect me to do?
Well, you were probably trying to recruit a new football coach, Nancy, and it's terribly important. I don't remember who wrote it, but I do remember when that program was written. It was written on a Sunday. Those were the good days when timesharing still ran on Sundays. It was written on Sunday after a certain Dartmouth-Princeton game in 1965 when Dartmouth won the Lambert Trophy. It's sort of a commemorative program.
There was also an earlier program for baseball, which is well remembered. I was just wondering, would somebody like to tell the Jolly Green Giants story?
Yes, I was wondering about that too. That should be told.
In the summer of 66, I got hired by the GE Research Lab to make a Chinese copy of the 265 software and install it down there. And at that time, GE itself had written a Fortran compiler to run on the 265 system for use with the commercial time-sharing service. But the time-sharing service people would not let the research lab have a copy of the program. So when I got the 265 installed and the software running at the lab in the one afternoon, I didn't have anything to do. I said, well, I'll try this Fortran. So I got out a manual and tried it. Aha! Put this line in the beginning of your program, you can print the object code. So printing the object code, pretty soon I discovered that, yeah, the right sequence of instructions, you're into an array. And at that point, I could write a disk read routine. So I wrote a disk read routine which read the Fortran compiler off the disk, encoded it in a suitable form for transmission by back to the teletype, and sat and punched it out. It took about 3 teletypes for 8 hours to punch the thing out. And then we read it into our 265, converted it to a deck, and we're running it quite normally. We had a program which we would run on the commercial time-sharing system once a week to discover whether there are any patches put in the program, so we could put them in too. And this went on for, we were merrily running this thing for about 2 months when my boss's boss goes to the time-sharing headquarters in Phoenix at that time and says, is up and running. We even have Fortran.
Who gave it to you? Where did you steal it? You know, who's the leak?
Very simple. When One of our people wrote a Fortran program to copy it off the disk. Don't believe it. Impossible. Can't be done. So he came back a few days later and related this story. So he said, well, sure, it's quite possible. We can read the disk. We can write the disk. So we proceeded to write a patch to the 235 exec onto the local time-sharing service in Schenectady, which would type out a message once a minute, Veni, Vidi, Victi. And we waited half an hour and no response, so we decided, well, we'll try New York City, 5DC. Message was, if you don't believe this, call Dan Scott at dial.com. Waited another half an hour, no response, so we decided we'll try Strike in Phoenix. So we put one in there which said, the jolly green giant strides through the valley of the sun. No response. This was midday type of time. So then I got and called up the trouble number for the Schenectady IFPC and it said, is time sharing running? Yeah. Are you sure about that? Are you going to look? Well, fine. Came back. Fine. Okay. Well, would you tell me what's coming out on the 235 typewriter? And he goes away. There's a silence for 10 minutes and the phone gets put back. Similar thing happens when I call up the New York Center. So I call up Phoenix and I get a very agitated person on the phone. Who's this? Who's this? And I say, the Jolly Green Giant.
In
a half an hour, we had a phone call back saying, yeah, you and the other fellow who did it, all expenses to Phoenix, show us how you did it, we'll give you the Fortran compiler.
In November 1964, Phoenix, my manager, told me I had 90 days to completely turn off the Dartmouth experiment. 87 days later, Dan Scott and I had gotten paying customers on the system, and on Sunday at 5 o'clock, I became unemployed.
It seems, I recall that Phoenix suffered a number of minor casualties like that, I guess you'd call it. In the Algol compiler, for a long time, there was a way of making fixes online. We put it in a way that made it very hard for the students to find out how to do it. Because using that, of course, you remember the thing about stuffing jumps to the bootstrap program. Well, you could have done that yourself, and all of those variations could have been done. It's very odd. I never did figure out why no student ever found that one. But it was very useful to us when we wanted to irritate the people in Phoenix who occasionally had irritated us back. And we could call them up over the telephone lines that they so kindly were providing us with. And we could kill their system in a way that would cause the typewriter to type out almost anything we like. And we would sit there, usually in the middle of the night, and compose little memos to them in their error messages, I guess you'd call it. But that was kind of a favorite pastime of ours in various different ways. During the early days, the computer center was used a lot for strict batch processing, card-oriented stuff, no time-sharing going on, so the DataNet 30 wasn't being used at all. And Ron, you wrote a program in the DataNet 30 that would just sit there and waste time and display something pretty in the lights until somebody went in there and modified it to use that feature of writing anything it liked into the 235. Only in this case, if I remember right, it waited 15 minutes to do it, and then what it wrote was in wrong parity, so the 235 came to a screeching halt.
Well, actually, it waited 10 minutes because it was called 10 Minutes to Live, yeah. And it was written specially for a particular faculty member at the engineering school who was not well enjoyed by the students, and he would come in and hog the machine during our development time for running his background freestanding Fortran programs. And in order to discourage him from getting too much work done, we set about writing this program. And he had seen the lights flash on a number of occasions before, never paid any attention to them. And in this particular case, we set the thing going, and he didn't pay any attention, and we went out and left. Came back a while later, and he was still trying to find out why he couldn't start it from scratch or do anything on 235. It was absolutely dead. Another little thing you saw before about being evasive and jumping around and watching when the bootstrap was catching up to you. There was another trick that got pulled once that was similar, but even worse. Rather than sitting there and trying to evade this captor that's trying to catch you, you can play another game. You can listen to all the requests in the mailbox and put back all the proper responses, but never do anything about them. Just make believe you're doing the things. And then you can use all the rest of your time, it's interrupt driven, use all the rest of your time to do whatever you wanted. Meanwhile, the Data 30 would think that it was sharing time for everybody in the world, but it really, it would never get upset because you kept responding. It would never try to wipe you out.
He never told us about that, did he?
I remember one of the first things I ever did when I learned something about the D30, I put a brand new command in. They had old, new, run, save. I put a command in called zip. Zip looked just like any other illegal command. It typed what question mark, just like an illegal command did. But it guaranteed that the next person swapped in was you. It was extremely handy for systems programmers, but they finally had to say, well, if two systems programmers who really wanted to get something done would just alternate. One would come in, the next one would come in, and no one else would get anything done. The system had something. If you did nothing for 10 minutes, they disconnected you, assuming you were a dead terminal. Some poor person was running a relatively short program, and after 10 minutes of waiting for something to happen, you got disconnected because they never even swapped in for 10 straight minutes.
There were actually other ways of causing the same thing. One problem was, once we had terminals upstairs, we still had a couple downstairs in the machine room, and those were the ones that the programmers normally used. And I know one fellow who is here, who one day was working, just doing some routine type work on the control teletype, and it got to be time for him to rush off to class. And he was in sort of a hurry and didn't think too much, and instead of typing goo or bye to sign off, he typed off, which leaves the control line working just fine. But no other users get anywhere. Kevin? Steve Garland suggested you should tell the Dartmouth Owl Golf story.
Oh, yes.
All right. Early on,
taking requests.
Oh, that's a whole other story. The Dartmouth, well, the compiler for ALGOL, at the top of its output, no matter what happened when you tried to do a run, would type out just the phrase Dartmouth ALGOL, and then would follow either output or program listing or whatever it was that you'd asked for. Yes, particularly in the early days, when all this thinking went on. And somewhere along the line, Phoenix, the GE people in Phoenix, asked for our whole system, including ALGOL. And we were worried at the time because we didn't like some of the ways the Phoenix people had been acting, like they were going to take the system and make it theirs. And we did, in fact, take things very personally. This was our system, and it was not about to become their system suddenly. So in the ALGOL compiler, we went to considerable pains to hide the code, boot out the phrase Dartmouth ALGOL. It didn't appear as text anywhere in the compiler. It was in there all right, but it didn't appear as text. And what's more, the stuff that put it out was disguised in the middle of the middle of several places. In one place was actually in the middle of the routine that loaded it onto the disk, modified everything to link it all together. And the routines that actually put it out looked like they were, I think the comment on them said something about padding the symbol seller, so that anybody looking at the listing couldn't possibly discover what was doing all that. And sure enough, about, I think, a month and a half after the first version of ALGOL got out there, we got a call asking, how in the world is that thing put out? Sure enough, they had wanted to take it out.
It's interesting to look at the original manuals that came out. They came up with the original manuals for the 265 system, and there was the General Electric Basic Manual and the Dartmouth ALGOL Manual. They never found out how to keep ALGOL from typing Dartmouth ALGOL.
The manual titles aren't even more interesting progression, because the original ones for the commercial system were GE stroke Dartmouth Basic. Then it went... Or Dartmouth stroke GE basic. Then it went GE stroke Dartmouth. Then they dropped the Dartmouth off.
All of that took place after mid-February 1965.
The keeping of Dr. Balgall's secret was even from the person who followed Mr. O'Gorman, Saab Lumsen, who isn't here. He had no idea how Dartmouth Algol was being put out until he said, gee, here's a subroutine that the Algol compiler doesn't need, and he erased it, and then he loaded up this new Algol system, and it typed out exclamation point, question mark, number nine, and said, ah, now I know why it's necessary. But the following student had no idea where the word Dartmouth Algol came out from until he stumbled on it by accident.
I'd like to tell a story about some of these early days. You can sort of tell that we were sort of misguided high school kids going to college. And one of the games we would play would be to go downstairs, and there was a control teletype. They could talk to any other teletype. And one of the features of this was that the other person didn't know that this had happened to him. So suddenly he was talking to you rather than whatever he thought was going on. And you generally go down there just before a football game or something when everybody was up there trying to impress their dates with the computer. And you'd take control of the computer, and so they'd be talking to you. You got some very interesting conversations. And what I remember was one of the games was to type as fast as possible, so they thought it was a computer rather than some stupid person downstairs. And somebody realized that there's a little more intelligence in this terminal than they thought, and started asking questions. And one of the questions they asked, what's the score of the football game going to be? So I said, well, I typed something very fast, 14-7. And I was right. And there's a big argument after the game up in that room saying, yeah, but the computer can predict these things. No, I didn't. I never did find out who it was. I just heard the reports of it.
Hey, Sidney, I'm still working on doing this information.
Incidentally, while Len Smith and Sidney are exchanging here, I don't think Len went into too great detail when he was talking about all the things that you can learn about the system by typing explain. There are some things they chose not to explain, but there are others that I believe if you type explain JGK, you still get a portrait. However, if you type explain Sydney, it still says there is no explanation for Sydney.
I remember the time, I think it was in the day where we're in the computer room in the basement there, and this official looking fellow, or I guess he was a fireman, came in. He had a radio in his hand, and he was very upset because he said that he'd been detecting unauthorized emissions on the official fire department channel, and he'd been going all over town trying to figure out who was putting out these signals, and he traced it to the computer room there. Well, lo and behold, he was right, of course. It was a 1 microsecond machine, so I think it had a strong signal in the megacycle wavelength or something of that sort. Well, we didn't really know what to do, so we struck a compromise, and that is that if there ever was a fire and they had to use their emergency radio, they would call us up and tell us to turn off the computer, and we would do that.
We discovered we could use that noise on an ordinary radio to make music, so this is sort of crude. Little radio by the console, take control of the time-sharing system. We never felt too much about users then. We had something to do. The users, you'd always go up there and there'd be a puzzled look, you know. Gave one a great sense of power, but looking back on it, it probably wasn't too mature.
Well, I think one thing we haven't talked about yet is the effect users had on the development of the system, and I would like to tell one story. When the system was first up on the air, my son was in grade school, fairly early grade, and therefore I was held up for giving a tour to his class to the computing center. And I think you saw some of the pictures. We were, of course, in the oldest building, and the equipment was down in the basement, but the teletypes were upstairs. And I gave a demonstration, a Model 33 teletype, and I had a couple of programs written that grade school kids would enjoy. And some they could sit down and type things in, and was very exciting. And then as a real treat, I took them downstairs to show them the computer. And my son's teacher called me up the next day and said, you might like to know what happened in show and tell. You know, they had to go next day and explain what their field trip was about. And she said it was really amazing. All the kids spoke up. They all enjoyed it very much. Then she asked, well, did you have any questions that didn't get answered? And one young lady raised her hand and said, well, I understood perfectly everything Kemeny did on the computer, and she summarized some of the things. But then he took us downstairs into the basement and showed us a great big box that looked like a refrigerator, and I never did find out what it was.